7 days a week in its pod format, podcast format. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are opening up today's program by previewing for you what sounds like a really terrific show that opens tonight at the Racine Theater Guild. It's a play called And In This Corner, Cassius Clay. And of course, Cassius Clay looms large as one of the greatest boxers in boxing history, Muhammad Ali. And this play tells the story of where he came from, and in a sense, his journey to the very top pinnacle of his sport. And I'm really excited that we can have on the morning show today, first of all, Sean Holmes, who is the director of this production, and Aquil Ocasio, who is one of the actors in the production, and he portrays Cassius Clay at one point in the boxer's life. And we will be finding out from them a bit about this show and the remarkable story that it tells, and the way in which it really illuminates for us who Cassius Clay was and the life forces that shaped him into the charismatic and utterly unique figure that he was, even beyond being a genius within the boxing ring. Sean Holmes and Aquil Ocasio, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah,
good to have you here. Let's get a couple of introductions out of the way. Sean Holmes, people who have been to the Racine Theater Guild have certainly seen you on that stage, perhaps more than once. My very first encounter with you was to experience your wonderful performance as the baker in Into the Woods.
Yes,
tell
yes.
us a little more about your life in the theater, and in particular, where people might have seen you locally.
So I'm primarily in Milwaukee County, and I do a lot of shows there. I consider it Skylight Music Theater my theater home, so I do a lot of stuff there. But I've come from Greendale Community Theater. I've done stuff in Madison. I've done stuff in Chicago. I'm just trying to get in as much theater experiences as I can while I'm on this green side of the earth. So,
Very good. Well, how about your experience as a director?
Fun fact, this is my first directing show ever.
Oh, wow.
Yes. I always wanted to do it, and I consider myself a student of theater from the beginning all the way till now. I take in as much as I can from everyone that I come across. And the timing right now is right, so I was able to do this directing as my first show, so I can't complain.
Wow, very good. So, happy to make the acquaintance for the first time of Aquil Ocasio. So tell us, Aquil, where you're from and a little bit about your background as a creature of the stage.
I'm from Racine. I'm born and raised and never moved. I've been in shows since sixth grade. First one I started out was Schoolhouse Rock,
wow.
Junior in my elementary school. And then I've just been mainly doing all just my school shows, nothing really too much outside of that. But and then I finally seen the poster for Cassius Clay. But fun fact, I was like 2 days too late when I seen the poster. So I didn't even get to audition on that. And then 2 weeks later, my theater teacher actually told me that he asked me if I wanted to do a show at the Theater Guild, and I was like, yeah. And he told me the show, and I was like, yeah, I was just wanted to audition for that one. So then he got me in contact with Sean, and this is my first ever one outside of school that I've done.
Very good. Where have you gone to school?
I've been to Starbuck Middle School, which is where I've done most of my shows, and then Case High School, which is also where I've done the second half of my shows.
Fantastic. Very good. So, Sean, I'm pretty sure you didn't have much in the way of the decision about the Theater Guild doing this show. I mean, there's a play reading committee that helps kind of put together a proposed season, which the board, of course, votes on. So
correct.
I assume that the first you even knew about this happening was when you got a phone call inviting you to be the director. Is that right?
Correct. I've heard of the play from before, Idris Goodwin, who wrote the playwright. I've heard about And In This Corner, of other fellow colleagues theater colleagues wanted to do this in Milwaukee, but this opportunity came, and so I absolutely jumped on, like I said before, jumped right on it. We did this journey together. So here we are, opening night.
Very good. Mm-hmm. So describe to our listeners, beyond the bare bones summary that I gave of how this play is crafted. I mean, and what unfolds from, I mean, not that there's a curtain at the Guild, but if there was a curtain from the moment the curtain goes up to the moment the curtain comes down, what kind of journey are we taking on?
Yep. So Cassius Clay is divided into three segments. We have young Cassius Clay. That's the majority of the, I call it the first half, Act One. And then the second half, Act Two, is where Aquila takes over to be older Cassius Clay. And then there is the narrator, who is like the ghost, the spirit, the older overseer Cassius Clay. He dictates the narration of the show, since he already lived that experience, while the two Cassiuses will go through the experiences themselves.
So do we hear from the narrator earlier? I mean,
he's the first one you hear talking, and then you'll see Aquila right next to him up stage more.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So we experience the first part of his life, and then the sort of the second part of his life, and then a narrator, the oldest iteration.
Correct.
He's the one who kind of guides us through all of this.
The show is only a few years of his life. So when he was young, around like 12-ish, and then up to when he's like 19 for the Olympics. So we're only working in that time span. And it's more focused on Cassius Clay versus Muhammad Ali. We know the boxer, Muhammad Ali, but we don't know who Cassius Clay is.
And Cassius Clay is his original name.
That is his government name, is what I like to call it, yes. So the premises of family and a young man becoming an adult during the 1950s in the Jim Crow era in Louisville, Kentucky.
Wow. So. I'm curious, Aquil, how much did you know about Cassius Clay before this play? I mean, I'm guessing you knew the name, but
yeah.
But otherwise, is this, have you ever followed the sport of boxing, or did you ever, for any reason, investigated who he was and anything about his story?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Previously, yeah, before this, I was I'm a big athlete fan. Like, I love sports. So that's my thing. So, like, I've known about boxing and stuff. And then, actually, when I was little, fifth grade is when I've heard, like, when I first knew what his actual name was about Cassius Clay from a site called Flocabulary. And that's, like, I used to like to listen to that song on repeat. So I kind of knew, I already knew about him and, like, his life. He was, like, one of the main people I studied when I was, like, trying to learn about what boxing like is and all that. And obviously, since he's a big black historical figure also in the sports industry, so that's also another reason I followed him. And I've done a project on him one time for a Black History Month project, so
okay.
And I've had my knowledge about him already.
So there's a lot coming together when you get to actually step onto the stage and portray him.
Oh, yeah.
Sean, you were saying the first part is when Cassius Clay is how old?
Around 12-ish.
Okay.
So that's where you get to meet Mom Odessa, you get to meet little brother Rudy, and then little Cassius comes out, and they're going through downtown Louisville. And then the next thing, you get to meet his good friend Eddie, young Eddie, and then start that process. And then the other characters throughout the show will debut themselves through all that. And then halfway through, Aquila will come in and take over as older Cassius.
And how much older are we talking about?
4 or 5 years later.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So that's not too far off from your real age.
Yeah. I play because he's 18 when he goes to the Olympics, and I'm 18 right now, so it's the perfect age right there, yeah.
Wow, and this sets us up for leading up to that, to his appearance at the Olympics?
Yep.
You may get to actually see parts of the fight in the show.
Wow. Yeah. Was that, do I remember, 1960?
Exactly, 1960.
Yep, okay. 1960.
All right. Very good. So, Sean, we can begin with you, but Aquil, feel free to jump in.
Right.
Tell us about this background of Cassius Clay in terms of, you've already touched on it, growing up in Louisville, Kentucky, and growing up amidst Jim Crow laws. I mean, most of us know at least something about that and about the pain that caused in the lives of so many blacks in the South.
Yeah.
How did Cassius Clay experience that in particular, and how do we see that for ourselves in the play?
So we get a glimpse of the start from where Cassius is coming from, his upbringing with his family, surrounded by the nuclear family with his mom and his dad and his brother being there. Where you get to see Eddie being almost like not the voice of reason, but the voice of reality, of how there is still the Jim Crow law era, the racism that's happening during that time. And then when Cassius becomes the great boxer, the beginnings of the great boxer, winning all these awards, winning all these tournaments and championships, and then when he gets to go to Olympics and win that as well, Cassius thinks like, okay, I am the king of the world in the boxing world, so I can be accepted by every single person since I was accepted at the Olympics. When he goes back home, he gets the same experience that he had when he left. And that is a rude awakening for that moment for Cassius, and you get to see that moment when he, during the play later on, and Eddie being his best friend, it gets to experience that with him. But Eddie's more a proactive person, and he does other things to help out the blacks in his community.
I agree with everything Sean said, because he goes to the Olympics and he's over here talking about being the best in the world, and in one part in the interview, not going to spoil too much, but they talk about the problems of how they treat the black people back in America. And even then he talks about how he's not, that they got people working on it, and that he's not, like, he doesn't really associate himself with that, but he said he's not too worried about how the outcome of it's going to turn out and everything. So that just further points the, like, he is up on that pedestal of, I'm accepted in the boxing world, so I don't need to be, like, ashamed of me, and, like, I'm going to be accepted by everybody. And then obviously how he comes back and he's like, oh, gets hit with the reality stick.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. He's a bit optimistic, maybe even a little naive about what real life is going to be.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, Aquil, when we think of Cassius Clay / Muhammad Ali, there is that really charismatic, flamboyant personality.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do in terms of embodying his personality? I mean, when we watch you on the stage, are you in a sense trying to imitate Cassius Clay as he spoke, as he moved around the world, or is this not that kind of endeavor?
I would definitely say that I've actually, when I was given the role of Cassius Clay, I went and watched the movie with Will Smith, Ali, to try to, and I, like, kind of studied it a little bit, and I looked a little into, like, some director's cut stuff to try to maybe figure out what I could probably put into maybe what Will Smith was, like, doing, or other points of what people were doing. And I tried to also find a video, if I could, of somebody else doing the play, but I couldn't find anything. I've been incorporating, I was gonna try to do how he talks, try to copy his voice, but I couldn't really get the voice down, so I kind of just keep it in my kind of voice, and I add a little bit of that country southern accent to whenever I could put that in there. And but I've mainly taken, like, I would study how he fights in the ring for when we do our fights. Like, I would try to keep his motions the same, like, even with his fancy footwork. Like, I've been working on that, trying to, you know, really portray Muhammad Ali for who he was, or Cassius Clay in this instance, for who he really was and how he was as a person. And I'm not really trying to incorporate myself, even though there's a couple times where I am going to put more of what I interpret into the show. But I mainly try to, you know, get how he's, like, talking, the way he holds himself, and with his, what was the word you used to describe him? His,
I would say he's almost, like, charismatic.
And, yes, and yeah.
Buoyant.
Yeah. Yeah, and I definitely put that into there with, you know, knowing when to have that charismatic trait, you know, showing it in the show with my lines and the way I move my body. I try to all incorporate all that into one to portray Cassius Clay.
Right.
Yeah.
Sean Holmes, you're the director, of course. Yes. Tell us about the way in which you've guided Aquil in some of these choices, and I suppose to some extent also letting him go with his own imagination. I suppose that's an interesting balancing act.
Yeah, with this being the first show that I ever directed, I wanted to make sure that each cast member had their own say of how they want to characterize their character. but I also said that I wanted to be guided with this direction for sure. With Cassius and with Aquil, I told him that I would like for you just to invest the time into seeing the character, which he is doing greatly well. And then I wanted to show a little more of the lovable side of Cassius later on, because in the beginning you get to see the flamboyant and the excitement and the charismatic of Cassius Clay, but then you also get to see that he truly loves his family, he truly loves his sports, and that he wants to do great for the family and great for the sports. And that is why people can interpret that he's very flamboyant and charismatic later on in his life, but I wanted that to come across, and Aquil does that beautifully.
Mm. Tell us about kind of the general tenor of the play in terms of seriousness versus humor, dark versus light, mm-hmm. in terms of, I mean, kind of the personality of it, whether it's a up play or a down play, or mm-hmm. kind of an interesting mix of the two.
Those that know me know that I try to be a funny person all day, every day.
Oh, yeah.
But the cast can tell you that I just like to randomly either bust out in a song or sing something.
All the time.
But this show does have a serious theme of equality and having a sense of family, leading that behind it as well. When we have our serious moments between certain characters with either Eddie or Joe Martin, who is played by Davison as well, I wanted that moment just to be isolated so you can see the importance of what's going on in that moment. There was a lot of things that happened in 1950s that are definitely not happening now or acceptable now. Shouldn't be acceptable then.
Right.
But I wanted to showcase, especially for the younger folks. Now, the newer younger folks, they didn't experience that, and they didn't know how it was then. I mean, I wasn't alive then, but I still got a remnant of that feeling from my parents.
Sure.
So I told them from Jump Street, I was like, we need to talk about anything, or if anything feels off, or if anything feels too serious, or the dialogue in the show that says stuff that are not acceptable now. We can talk about that, because you probably don't hear it as much, or the reference of why is the Freedom Fighters being said? What is our Cassius Marcellus Clay? What are these things? Why is there a white only sign that's happening right there? So I wanted to make sure everyone was comfortable and knowledgeable going into the show, so they can tell the show correctly.
Right. Mm-hmm. Aquil, what kind of a learning experience has this been for you as one of the young people Sean was just referring to, where thankfully some of what we're talking about, some of the most awful sort of Jim Crow laws and so on, is not a part of your reality. Not that there aren't still matters of injustice that still need to be addressed, but, you know, nevertheless, this is about an era with which you have no direct acquaintance. What kind of learning experience has this been for you?
It was more of a, I definitely, because how I've been educated on, obviously, on this topic, I actually went and talked to my great-grandma when she's still alive, so I actually went and talked to her about this time to try to see if, like, she could give me some insight of, like, how it was and how, when she would tell me about how, like, some, because she's had some experience too, so she was like, when she would tell me about what happened and how she would feel about it, I'd kind of try to, I'd be like, okay, so if I get something similar to this in the show, like, I'm gonna kind of portray how she was, like, acting, how she would feel, or how I would have felt at the time if I was in that position. But on the learning experience of being in this show, I'm always taking like, you know, new things from everybody, whether it's to portray this emotion a different way or try maybe two or three different ways, from learning from, like, you know, Sean telling me one thing all about, like, staying in the light. That's been one big thing. Oh,
my cast does not like to stay in the light.
Oh, not at all.
Find your light.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, like, knowing that. And then I went to my theater teacher about that, actually. And then I was like, how do I know, like, when I'm in the light so I don't have to, like, look down?
Right.
And then, which taught me the thing about, we're told about our noses. You can see the light on your nose, and that's when you know you're in the right light.
Okay.
And then, like, even other people in the show, like Davidson, how he said, who plays Joe Martin, learning from him, because he's been in past shows at the Theater Guild.
Yes.
So, like, I would learn some stuff from him, maybe ask him a thing or two for some tips helping out, and then, you know, still staying to myself too about what I've been taught throughout my years and applying it into the Theater Guild. And it's been definitely a new experience since this is bigger than just my school.
Yeah.
And seeing everybody, like, I don't see these people every day at my school, so it's not like I could just be walking down the hall and be like, oh, hey, like, oh, you want to do this with me to practice or whatever? And it's like, no, we only have really this time. And it's been a new experience, but it's been great.
Right.
Yeah.
And yeah, that interesting Theater Guild thrust stage where you have the audience almost on all sides of you. It's kind of an interesting thing to experience. You mentioned Davidson Kane, who's in the cast. Mm-hmm. Tell us who his character is and what he represents in this story.
Joe Martin is the boxing training coach that finds Cassius and molds him to be what we know as the greatest boxer of all time. He has a Columbia gym, and he accepts every single person that he sees great potential in. White, black, mixed, what doesn't matter, color, or any of that sorts. And that tone is set right away with Davidson.
Wow, very good. For those of you just joining us, we are talking about the latest production at the Racine Theater Guild. It's a play called And In This Corner, Cassius Clay by Idris Goodwin. And the play opens tonight at the Racine Theater Guild, and it only runs this weekend and next weekend. So this is a play that if you are interested in seeing it, you need to make sure to make your plans and get your tickets to experience this. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the boxing. I assume there is some boxing. Mm-hmm. First of all, tell us how much boxing there actually is, and for instance, do we ever see Cassius Clay boxing an opponent, or is this maybe a little more kind of impressionistic situation?
I said to the creative team, if we're going to do a show about boxing, there needs to be some physicality of boxing. And you get three opportunities to see that. And I don't want to give too much away, but there are moments in the three boxing that it looks so realistic. And you're just like, oh, okay, did you really hit him? But no, but it's all safe. We have our fight choreographer, Travis, who comes in and goes over the boxing with everybody that is a part of the physicality of the boxing itself.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, you know, for both of you, if this is new territory in terms of you know, being on the theatrical stage and this kind of physical kind of endeavor. I mean, if either of you come at this as, you know, for instance, athletes who have, you know, competed, if not in boxing specifically, but I mean, what does it mean to be doing theater with this sort of added element?
I would say, I've come from an athletic background with doing sports all my life. So I would say it's more of a controlled chaos when you're doing fight choreography.
Oh, yeah.
So everything is planned down to the T. Like right hook, you need to dodge that right hook. Uppercut, you need to follow that uppercut. But then we have it going down to like slow-mo so everyone can see exactly what's happening, and then it speeds up, controlled chaos. So I want to make sure that everyone is safe in the ring and people watching feel that they're safe watching it, like no one's going to get hit.
Good point. So, Aquil, what is your background, athletically speaking, and then maybe more specifically, anything like this? I mean,
I've done sports my whole life too. I've always stayed active as a kid, and I've had a little bit of fighting experience. I've done a couple classes of different fighting styles, and boxing was one of them. I took like two boxing classes before in my life. So I've already relatively knew how what I was kind of doing, and like footwork and all that. I kind of knew how to do that, so I wouldn't. I made sure that was like a big thing I wanted to keep, because I didn't want to like fall over, you know, in the ring or whatever.
Yeah,
while
trip
I'm
over
on
your
stage.
Own 2 feet. Yeah.
Yeah, and but incorporating that, because taking those classes and then doing boxing there and taking classes and then doing it on the stage were definitely two different. Obviously two experiences that were way different, because now I'm not making contact anymore. I'm just still doing the same motion, but I'm making sure I'm a certain distance away so I don't hit my opponent for real, or, you know, even just to keep us both safe. And It's not necessarily difficult to really do it. It's more of making sure I'm doing it how our fight choreographer wants us to do it. Like when we do maybe like jabs and we have to go over the shoulder instead of, and like kind of go past the shoulder, making sure we get that so it looks more realistic is definitely one of the more difficult parts, and making sure it's timed, like, you know, the reactions are timed perfectly so it doesn't look like it's too fake, even though it is.
Right.
And that's mainly what I usually think about every time I'm doing this.
So you want it to be make-believe, not fake.
Of course, yes, yeah,
right.
Of course.
And of course, it's in that thrust stage at the Guild, it probably is even more challenging, because if it was just a proscenium stage, you could maybe put those fights a little bit farther from the audience, but you are right almost in the middle of the audience, and so they're going to see everything. So the eye for detail is really important.
I made sure I told every actor, just because you give the front of the audience some love, and make sure you get stage left and stage right some loving too, because they will see everything, so make sure you give them some loving from your face.
Right.
Yes.
So, Sean, this is the very first production you have directed. You've been directed quite a lot in your young life, but never been the director. What's been maybe most surprising about wearing this particular mantle of responsibility that maybe even as an experienced performer you didn't necessarily fully expect?
Everything is on you. The amount of emails, texts, phone calls that I get from the creative team, the cast, parents that are of the cast, it is an eye-opener and an appreciation for every other director that has done it before me, that directed me. My hat's off to them. I ask my friends that are directors now, and I said, what am I going to expect? They're like, anxiety and stress. I said, okay, I'm ready for that. My first theater director from high school, Miss Kaz, I always got to call her Miss Kaz. She checks on me every now and then just to make sure, how is your first directing going? How is the cast? Good. Are they stressing you out? How are those parents? And like, she is just like the voice of reasoning, and keeps my soul calm, and she knows how I operate. And so I have friends and family like that in my circle that are definitely pushing me up when sometimes I don't feel like, I don't think I did that good. I always second guess myself, like I'm my worst critic, like everyone else is their own worst critic. But when I come back the next day and I see my cast go on there and listen to the directions and notes that I give them and implement that for the next run, I'm like, I'm doing something right. I'm doing something right.
So. Quill, I want you to follow up. What's it been like to be directed by Sean in this endeavor?
It's been definitely a great experience. Going into this, I thought I was going to have more of all black cast, but I was like, and then when I've seen a couple, there's a couple people who aren't, and I've done a show like this previously, where a show called Milk Like Sugar at my school, where I've had the all black cast, you know, I've had a black director before, so I've been in that experience before, and learning from Sean has definitely been one of my most favorite. He's definitely like one of my favorite directors I've ever been with.
Young man.
Oh no, it's so true, because I think the amount of times that I think I've laughed has been, like, at least laugh, I'd say, well over 10 times, at least every rehearsal. Mm-hmm. And it's Sean, he has his moments where he's, like, when he gives us notes, he's that serious, like, oh, we need to be doing this, making sure we're in line. But he also keeps that sense of where we can basically stay comfortable with him. Like, he doesn't make us feel resentment towards him, like we don't want to come up to him with a problem. Like, he's always an open, you know. It's different when you have a director where it's more makes you feel scared, because also another one of our castmates, Luke, who plays like our ring announcer, a couple of different characters, he was also saying the same thing. We talked about it last night, where he was like, he's had some directors where they're like, you know, this is what it is, and if you don't have it like this, like, they're going to be on you. Mm. But more with Sean, he's like, he has that, this is what it's going to be. And even if, like, we make the same mistake a couple times, you know, he'll do the same thing, and then, but if it keeps going, he'll be like, all right, like, this, we got to keep doing it. But it's still, even then, when you got to tell some people, like, five times, whatever, like, it's still, at the end of the day, he's always a happy spirit at the end of the day, and it's I couldn't have asked for a better director.
Patient and positive, it sounds
always,
like.
Yes, always, yes, always.
I wanted to set an environment where the cast can come back the next day and still want to do it.
I love that. Yeah. And I'll give you a quick chance to say something nice about Aquila Casio. if there's something you can think of to say.
So this young man to the left of me, for those that can't see, he's to the left of me, is so intuitive to his character and to his craft at such a young age. It's remarkable. When I would give Aquila notes, he would take that to heart and then try to deconstruct it and make it, what can he do for that scene, especially the intimate moments where he's talking about the injustices back home, or when he's with his family, like the sweeter moments when he's talking to his mom about, will you write me when you're overseas? Or when he's fighting in the ring and showing his boxing aggression in that sense, and then the next scene he's coming out and being best friends with Eddie. Mm-hmm. He's taking all those directions amazingly, and it's making my life as a director so much easier. And it's nice because he's also being a mentor to the younger ones, the younger three, and I don't think he knows this. You have three young castmates underneath him, watching him and what he does and how he listens to everyone else around him, how he reacts on stage. And so, yes, me being the older person in the room, one of the oldest person in the room, they have someone closer to their age. I'm like, I want to be just like what he does. I want to do that. And he's a great role model for those three young castmates. So I truly appreciate that. So.
Of course.
That's terrific. Yeah. That's terrific. Well, the play once again is And in This Corner, Cassius Clay by Idris Goodwin. And it opens tonight at the Racine Theater Guild. It runs Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then the following weekend as well. And you can go to racinetheater.org for more information, and you can also call the box office, area code 262-633-4218, to get ticket information for you to see. And in this corner, Cassius Clay. The director, Sean Holmes, and one of the Cassius Clays in this production, Aquil Ocasio. Thank you to both of you for joining me today on The Morning Show. I'm excited to see this play. I hope a lot of other people are excited as well. And thanks for helping to bring this important work to the public.
Of course.
Thank you.
Can't wait. Yeah.
And to finish out the Friday Morning Show here on WGTD, here is a portion of the conversation I recorded back in 2017 with best-selling author Paul Beston, talking about his book, The Boxing Kings, When American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring. It focuses on seven great American heavyweight boxing champions. Of course, one of the figures who really looms large in this parade of champions is Jack Johnson. And you title his chapter Pariah, because, of course, that is ultimately his destiny. But before that, he is one of the most famous people in the world. One of the things that says something about the world in which Jack Johnson rose to prominence and ultimately won such prominence was something you tell us about the film that was made of his, I believe, his victory over Tommy Burns. That was in 1908. I think that's maybe when he gained the title. That is Jack Johnson. Tell us what was done to the film of that fight, the end of that film.
This was a fight that took place in Australia, in Sydney, Australia. And I should back up a little and say that by the time 1908 rolled around, this thing, as I described, this heavyweight title had become, quickly becoming a sort of an institution, becoming a commercial prize and something that Americans identified with the country. And, of course, in the racial climate of that time, the idea of a black man holding that title was very threatening to millions of people. And so there had been essentially an agreement that blacks would just not even get a chance to challenge for the title. In fact, Sullivan made it explicit in an announcement that he would never fight a black fighter. So no one had gotten a chance at it. And Johnson got his chance not only because he was the outstanding challenger, but because the champion at the time, Tommy Burns, a Canadian, essentially set a very high price $30,000, which doesn't sound like much now, under the strong confidence that no promoter would ever pay such a thing. And that way he could just say, hey, I said I would fight him, but nobody won't pay me. Well, guess what? The promoter came up with the money. So they went to Australia for the fight. Johnson just trounced Burns as one of the most one-sided title fights in memory. And it was filmed. You know, parts of it still survive today. But I got this last piece of information from Jeffrey Ward, who wrote a very comprehensive book about Johnson called Unforgivable Blackness, which was also part of Ken Burns based his documentary on that. And I had always read before then that what had happened was that just as he was about to, just as Johnson was about to have the climactic blow in the 14th round when Burns was ready to be knocked out, that the police had stormed the ring and cut off the film. They were getting ready to get into the ring, but Ward found through his research that an original print of the film actually did show Johnson in victory. In other words, the idea was that they didn't want anyone to see him in this final moment of triumph because it would be, you know, too alarming, too shocking for Americans to see. What I didn't know until reading Jeffrey Ward's book was that the original footage actually did exist of the final victory, but it was then edited out, cut out of subsequent films. So it's lost forever at this point. So
right.
For our purposes, it may as well have happened the way that it used to.
Right, exactly. But it was thought that the sight of that would have been intolerable to the typical white American, certainly.
That's right.
You tell us that James Johnson rose as part of the generation of blacks who were born free, but in an age of racial retrenchment. And so it makes his rise to greatness in some respects all the more astonishing and impressive. But of course, as many people know, Jack Johnson is also a figure who is remembered almost more for how he lived his life outside of the ring, in terms of discarding just about every social and social rule of decorum of the day. How would you have us remember him? I mean, what do you think is most important? I mean, should we discard the one and only think about the other, or do they all matter in terms of his importance and significance?
Well, I think I say near the end of my chapter that in my view, he might be the most complex of all of these characters. And I don't think I have, you know, a full beat on him myself. He's a complicated figure, and he was a man of remarkable intelligence. You know, what's interesting about him is that when he was born in 1878, both his parents were literate, which was pretty unusual for a black child to have two literate parents in 1878. I mean, Reconstruction was just ending. And, you know, getting literacy and all these other opportunities for blacks was hardly universal. So he had some advantages, and he was literate himself, and all of the Johnson children were literate. His parents were very determined to get them educated. And so he was a very, very, very bright man. But he was also just almost a chronic kind of self-mythologizer. You know, his stories about himself, I think I also say in the chapter, really can't be verified without secondary sources. You know, he has an autobiography in which he's telling stories about his early travels, and one of which he's fighting a shark. He single-handedly kills a shark who's attacking his fishing boat or something. It's just, you know, it has this ring of just, you know, absurdity to it. It's highly entertaining. But, of course, this this went along with his presentation to the public. He was very he had no lack of self-confidence. He also had no lack of courage. He was not afraid of white condemnation, and that does make him really remarkable at a time when you know, it wasn't just a disapproval that you could risk running, but death, certainly violence. He really crossed the white line when he was getting involved with white women. I mean, that was the thing that finally, it was bad enough for whites that he was holding this world title, but the fact that he was consorting with white women and eventually marrying them was just a bridge too far. That was the ultimate primal fear of all, was interracial relationships. And the other aspect of it, though, that Johnson added to the mix was that most of these women, not all, but most, were prostitutes. So he had an absolute delight in prostitutes and in vice. He loved nightclubs and drinking and fast cars and fancy clothes and the whole thing. So he was a man who just wanted to live his life with pleasures. And he would often run into criticism from blacks, too. Booker T. Washington was no friend of Jack Johnson. He thought he was a terrible example for the race, as it was called back then. And so he caused a lot of blacks discomfort, too, because of their fear that he was going to bring, basically arouse hostility that they were going to end up paying for. Because, in fact, and this did come to pass in some extent, because when he won his most famous fight in 1910, when he beat James J. Jeffries, there were race riots. So a lot of blacks had a kind of mixed feeling about him on the title, because they were very proud on the one hand, but on the other hand, many of them wished that he would live more quietly.
When we turn to the next great champion, a guy by the name of Jack Dempsey, in a chapter called Million Dollar Hobo, you tell us about his impressive rise out of a very unpromising beginning. I mean, a hard youth and early on in his boxing career, all kinds of really discouraging reversals, which would seem to give no indication of the great champion that he was to ultimately become. You tell us in the year 1918, he has the most dominant year in all of heavyweight boxing, 19 wins, 17 by knockout, 12 are first round knockouts. This is when he's just on the edge of becoming heavyweight boxing champion. This guy who comes up from the trenches, from very much a working class background and very limited education. But I was very surprised to read in this chapter that Jack Dempsey often at his fights was booed. Tell us more about the way in which he was viewed by the public and how his impressive victories were often seen and received by the public.
Yeah, Dempsey was a figure like a lot of modern celebrities. He has that kind of love-hate. He prompts those kinds of conflicting emotions in people. On the one hand, people absolutely loved him because he was so magnetic as a fighter in the ring, and he's really the guy who brings this faster, real frankly more violent style of fighting that had been seen before, and many people would see 50, 60 years later a successor to that style and approach in Mike Tyson, who in fact did admire Dempsey. So as a fighter, he's an electric attraction. But on the other hand, he was coming along right in the wake of World War One, and World War One was a traumatic social experience in the United States, as it was obviously in the European countries. But the whole issue of serving in the military was just a huge one in the country, and able-bodied men who did not serve for whatever reason were called slackers, and that was an old-fashioned usage of that term, not like today where it's kind of got a kind of flight from social responsibility, sort of started with sort of Generation X kind of thing. But this was really about manhood. A slacker was someone who was half a man, who was refusing to suit up and fight for his country, was essentially a coward. Dempsey did not fight in the war. He got a deferment from the government. He pleaded that he was the sole support for his parents and some siblings, a widowed sister. The deferment was approved. His case on the surface was perfectly legitimate. On the other hand, you have to, there's certainly plenty of tens of thousands of other American men who probably could have, made the same case. Everybody has a life, after all. Everybody has responsibilities. So he, when he won the title, people began to look back at that, and he heard plenty of criticism in the sporting press. He heard criticism from Stars and Stripes, the military newspaper, and eventually when he started getting in the ring against other opponents, a substantial portion of Americans were rooting against him, even when he fought a Frenchman, which is kind of hard to believe today. But the Frenchman he fought in 1921 happened to be a war hero for France, Georges Carpentier. And a lot of Americans were rooting for Carpentier against Dempsey, who they saw as a slacker. So he had a long time living down that reputation.
And, of course, in your book, we can read all about important fights in his career, including that famous fight with Gene Tunney, the man who defeats him and defeats him again in that famous long count battle. And we learn so much more about this intriguing figure, someone whom we know the name well, but not always the man. And, of course, you also paint for us a rich, detailed portrait of one Joe Louis, a towering champion in the 1930s and 40s. One of the things I learned from your chapter on Joe Louis was the fact that the timing of Joe Louis's emergence was, in a sense, just right in terms of the American public being ready for that color line to be crossed again. Tell us the way in which that was so.
Yeah, Louis came along he ended up winning the title 22 years after Jack Johnson had lost it, and in that span of time, no black fighter had been given another chance at the heavyweight title. I was describing how the people didn't want Johnson to get the chance. Well, after Johnson, they say, "Oh, see, I told you that was a bad idea. We're never going to do that again." So there was a ban on, essentially a ban on blacks getting a shot at the heavyweight title. Dempsey did not fight the leading black challenger of his day, and so it was a long time before Joe Louis came along that this opportunity came along again. Louis was so good, was such a phenom in running through the ranks that was one part of it. He was just creating excitement, and this was Depression era boxing now, and boxing was looking for a shot in the arm. Attendance was declining, and people just didn't have money to go to fights the way that they had. So he was creating a sensation. That was one part of it. And, it had been, there were attitudes slowly changing anyway. And the last thing with Louis was that he had a management team, that was very determined to avoid any of the buttons pushed by Johnson. So they devised a whole public presentation plan for him that would make him as inoffensive as possible. He would never gloat. He would never, gloat over white opponents. Needless to say, he would never be seen with white women. That kind of stuff. That whole list of rules drawn up. The interesting thing about those rules, though, and they're often remarked upon today, obviously very much a result of their time and very condescending to read today. But on the other hand, the interesting thing about them is that most of them Louis would have ended up following anyway. Because that was the kind of person he was. He was not a gloating type. He tended to be pretty stoic. He had a slight speech impediment. He had learned to speak late. He was always a little shy about, too much speaking. He was a man of few words. And so he was very comfortable letting his fists do the talking and letting other people do, project whatever they wanted to project upon him. He was okay with not being a kind of Johnson figure. So it worked fine for him. He was a perfect fit for it. And then the fighting ability did the rest.
Paul Beston's book is The Boxing Kings, When American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring, published by Roman and Littlefield. And one more reminder that the play And In This Corner, Cassius Clay, opens tonight at the Racine Theater Guild. Call 633-4218 for more information. And we want to mention that also opening tonight, but at Carthage College in the Warburg Auditorium, a Spanish masterwork, Life is a Dream, by Pedro Calderon de la Barca. And there are performances this weekend and the following weekend. We'll have a morning show conversation about that next week, but we just wanted to remind you about the opening of this amazing play. It's a relatively rare opportunity to encounter this masterpiece on the stage. Go to carthage.edu/theater for more information. Our weather forecast calls for sunny skies today, and we're headed for a high of 25 degrees, so a bit more comfortable than we've had recently. Still pretty cold overnight, under clear skies, an overnight low of about 10 above. Tomorrow, Saturday, sunny skies, and we'll warm to a high of 30 degrees. On Sunday, sunny skies and a high of 36. And actually, first thing next week through at least Monday and Tuesday of next week, we will have daytime high temperatures squarely in the low to mid 40s. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine,